on this episode of The Jason Wright Show.
And for running a multi-million dollar drug business, when I was 19, I was making over $2 million a year. I had crazy stuff, you know, anything you could imagine in that world I acquired, and everything collapsed when I was 23 years old. I was incarcerated, I was sentenced to 7 years in prison, and that's when I found out I had a whole bunch of health issues. My cholesterol levels were through the roof, high blood pressure, was placed on medication, and from there was when I found out I had all these problems, and it really shocked me, because I was 23 years old. I didn't feel like I was gonna die tomorrow, but the doctor there told me if I kept living the lifestyle I was living, you know, smoking, drinking, eating incorrectly, and that I could probably die of a heart attack within 5 years.
Koss, the boss. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. How you doing?
Man, I am very well, and I'm so grateful to have you here. So I got to tell you, let me just back up to where I found you and where I first learned of your story. I'm reading Big Little Breakthroughs by Josh Linkner, and he puts in there the story of Koss the boss, this guy that basically was a kingpin, drug kingpin from East Manhattan, went to prison, and then after that completely turned his life around while he was incarcerated. And man, your story, it's like something out of a movie. And if you haven't optioned the movie rights to your story, you probably should. And the best part about it is, Koss, it has a happy ending. And so I don't want to get in the way. I want you to kick this off, and you start wherever you want to. And just to let you know, kind of like I just talked about right before we came on, I've got to believe that your story has given hope and inspiration to so many people, because one of the things I talk about a lot is a lot of the things we believe ourselves are society's rules piled on us, and what matters most is what's between our ears and what we believe about ourselves. And the way you have executed on from your journey to where you are now. And then I got to bring this up because it meant a lot to me. So on Combody's website, the first thing I see is change your body, change the world. And I want you to touch on that a little bit at some point in this conversation, because, you know, the motto for my podcast is improve always in all ways. And my selfish mission in this podcast and in everything I do, my Vitruvian Project, is I believe if I am the absolute best version of myself, that the fruit of that will spill over into my fellow man. And so it sounds like we've got some lined up philosophies there. But with that, I'm going to sit back and you take the mic, brother, and just introduce yourself to this audience and give us as much of your story, starting wherever you want to.
No, thank you, Jason. Change your body, change the world. You know, touching that, we wrote that with the aspect of, like, you know, our mission, what we do at Combody. I founded this company called Combody, which hires people coming out of the prison system to teach fitness classes. And so, you know, we always discriminated against people that have been incarcerated. And it's been a big perception that we see in the media that, you know, we're locked up caged animals and predators and all this other stuff. And I feel like, you know, if we start changing our views and really seeing the person for just being a human being, and that's what we do. You know, you work out with us, you're matched with somebody that's been incarcerated, you take one of the classes or one-on-one training, and you really start changing your perception. You know, it's this person's gonna greet you with a smile, this person's gonna push you and inspire you to, you know, push yourself to the next level. You're at your most vulnerable state, you know, you're in a weak position, you know, and like, you're just opening up and trusting this person's gonna guide you in the right place. So that was our concept with, like, you know, changing your body and changing the world. But getting back to a bit about my story, you know, I got into the world of fitness because I went into prison, and I went into prison for running a multi-million dollar drug business. When I was 19, I was making over $2 million a year. I had crazy stuff, you know, anything you could imagine in that world I acquired. And everything collapsed when I was 23 years old. I was incarcerated. I was sentenced to 7 years in prison. And that's when I found out I had a whole bunch of health issues. My cholesterol levels were through the roof, high blood pressure, was placed on medication. And from there was when I found out I had all these problems, and it really shocked me, because I was 23 years old. I didn't feel like I was gonna die tomorrow, but the doctor there told me if I kept living the lifestyle I was living, you know, smoking, drinking, eating incorrectly, and that I could probably die of a heart attack within 5 years. And so that really like shocked me. I was like, I'm not gonna die in prison, you know, like. And what they recommended was to eat correctly, and obviously in prison you don't get the best food, and to work out. And so that's one thing I did. I worked out obsessively. I started off with like running, jogging in the yard, power walking, and just progressively, like, you know, working out 3 hours a day at a certain point. I would run for like 2 hours, go back to my cell, do a whole bunch of calisthenic workouts. And I lost 70 pounds in 6 months. And, wow. And I did it. I had the time to do it, you know. Yeah. And I think that's one thing that a lot of people say, you know, when they struggle to work out, is that I don't have time, you know. And our motto is do the time, you know, mm-hmm. like commit that time to, you know, concentrate on yourself. You have one body, right. You know, if the body's gone.
Yeah,
we're gone. Right. You know? So like, right. We need to work on our own tempo.
Well, here's what I want to dive into a little bit, because one of the things that I see with you, Koss, is your mind is something special. Because how many times do we hear? I mean, you're a millionaire. You're making millions of dollars at the age of 19. How many times do you hear this story of people going, "Gosh, if only they would put that talent and that entrepreneurial spirit to good use, how much more successful could they be?" And you did that. But I want to take it back, because this is what I know about you. You are a first generation immigrant, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so you come to the States, I believe, in your mother's womb in 1985, right?
Yeah, my mom was pregnant with me.
That's what I thought. So you come here, you end up in Manhattan, and then all of a sudden you grow up in not exactly the nicest part of Manhattan. If I mean, you weren't around Madison and Fifth, am I right?
No. Yeah, when people hear Manhattan, they don't even bad parts of Manhattan, because, you know, people think about Times Square and all that stuff, but mm-hmm. and Harlem is part of Manhattan, and yep. You know, Washington Heights, you know, we had the musical. That was one of the, that's like the drug central of probably the country, because there was like a lot of drugs going through that neighborhood. But I was in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, which was a place that nobody wanted to move to.
Yeah. And so tell me what it was like in those early days building your mind. You know, you're in survival mode, and I've got to believe you had a lot of just survival in you from where you were, the background you were coming from. Again, you know, you're having a different American experience than your mom had. What was that like? And then one of the things I want to lead up to. So I'm sure a lot of the listeners, man, they've seen Goodfellas. They've seen this kind of romantic vision of being able, you know, who can forget the scene where, you know, Ray Liotta's character walks in the back of the club and meanders through the kitchen and basically goes the long way, but has a table brought out to him to the front that didn't even exist before. I mean, kind of like the world is your oyster. I want you to take us from growing up in that survival mode and then to that moment at 23 when all of a sudden, I got to believe, when you walked in different places, I mean, you were Koss the Boss. So you walk in places, you get treated a certain way. Then all of a sudden, man, at 23, you realize what's going on, all of that's gone. All the power, all the money. And I want to know what that felt like and how you kept from letting that cripple you. Instead, you build upon and you make this incredibly successful business. But just talk to the listener that doesn't have a concept of what it's like growing up in the environment that you survived in.
Yeah, I mean, surviving there was just a hustle as a kid. I was, you know, my mom immigrated from the Dominican Republic with pretty much nothing. We basically, like, we had family down here, and I'm still living in the same area, but which completely changed now. It's like a super gentrified gallery poodle walking neighborhood. but we lived on my aunt's couch, and that's how I grew up, you know. And as a kid, I would ask my mom, like, you know, for things that other kids had. And I grew up in a poor neighborhood, and I was the poorest kid in the neighborhood.
Wow.
You know, I was the kid that didn't, you know, my mom would go to Salvation Army and, you know, get whatever they give out there, or, you know, buy something at a huge discount, you know. So I was hungry. I was like, you know, I was always like, damn, why? I want that, I want this. But my mom was like, you know, she couldn't afford it. So that would frustrate me. And I would, like, just, I don't know, it just came out of nowhere, I guess, you know. But also seeing, like, her hustle and just her grind, I think it was something that I just saw and was implemented in my DNA, that I just, like, you know, started hustling outside in the streets. I didn't start selling drugs at like 5 years old. I actually used to, like, walk from door to door and collect cans, you know, from everybody in the building, you know. And, like, I would be the kid with a big ass, like, sorry, excuse my language, with a huge ass, a garbage bag, you know, just with a whole bunch of cans and bottles, and then going down to the corner bodega and changing them for nickels, or, you know, searching for change in people's sofas. That's the mindset that I had, you know. Or I would open up the fire hydrant and wash cars, you know, as they went by. I would, like, spray them and be like, hey, you got to wash your car now. So, and that was it, you know. And that's how I grew up, you know, making money and figuring things out. And then time went on where I just saw people on my block, on my corner, where I saw them, you know, selling drugs. I saw lines of people lining up for heroin. And I saw the guys that were standing at the end of the line with the chains, you know, with the cars, with, you know, with the women's. And I thought that was success, you know. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be that person, you know. And I, that was just like, I glorified that, you know.
Right.
And I just followed their path, you know. I started hanging out with them, like, so the, you know, the growing up in the neighborhood I grew up in was, like, free to roam around. When you're a kid, like my mom trusted, mm-hmm, the guys on the corner, trusted the bodega in the corner, you know, trusted everybody. Everybody knew each other, you know.
Right.
And so it was not like, you know, where's my kid? I lost my kid. It was like, you know, you go out. Mm-hmm. And now my kid is on a computer or a tablet or playing video games at home.
Right.
Before, we didn't want to go inside.
Right.
The fight to, like, stay outside. But that's what I saw growing up. And I thought, you know, if I could make it this way, you know, I made it. And so I got involved with drugs at 11. I was, you know, smoking weed and hanging out with the guys in the corner. And then I started dealing weed at 13. At school, it just became a supply and demand. You know, every kid in my middle school knew that I was smoking weed. And so they were like, you know, can you go to your cousin in the corner and buy me a nickel? And so, mm-hmm, I would, you know, do them the favor and go over there, and then I'll smoke with that person for free. And so I went up to my cousin. I was like, can I get an ounce? And so, bought an ounce of weed for $100 and made $300 out of it, and just kept, you know, progressing from there. And then I quickly got involved with, like, coke and crack, and that was just crazy.
And what's one of the biggest misconceptions that people have about that life? I mean, I look at it and I go, was it scary? Were you frightened at night? I mean, it's got to be competitive. Or was there enough security, enough respect for territory? I mean, what do people not understand about that life?
I mean, all of the above. You know, it was there was respect, there was disrespect. You know, there was back then everybody sold drugs on a different block. So a guy that had my mom's block, I couldn't sell drugs on that block. On my mom's block, I had to sell drugs two blocks down. And I remember fighting because I did, you know, I got into a big fight with some guy that was on my mom's block. And, but yeah, it was very territorial. But like, I don't know, it was, you had to be tough, you know, you couldn't be pushed around. Cause if somebody thought you was like a punk or something, you know, like they was going to take, you would probably get robbed, and I've been robbed before. Mm-hmm.
And what would you do to make yourself mentally prepared for the life? I mean, you know, because a lot of people, you were around a lot of guys that were doing that you were basically supervising. So you became Cost the Boss. But what mentally did you do? I mean, what was there a certain philosophy that you subscribed to? Was it still that hunger, just saying, I'm going to reach the height, whatever the heights of this is, that's where I'm going, because I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired of my mom not being able to provide the way she wants to. I mean, what was it that you would tell yourself to drive you forward? Because I got to believe that ultimately you channeled that energy into something very positive, first with your physical fitness, then with ComBody. But what was it back then that you would resolve internally to keep yourself fortified and prepared from one day to the next?
I was money hungry.
Okay.
I was just, and I hated people that procrastinated.
Okay.
If you were just wasting times, like I thought time was money and you needed to like capture every single moment, and like, you know, whoever fell asleep was losing out on money. And so I would stay up for 3 days at a time, you know, just nonstop hustling. And so that's how I got my friends to hustle for me. Basically my friends that were like just hanging out on the corner smoking weed and not doing anything with their life, just hanging out. And I'm like, yo, you guys are wasting time. I got this huge demand that I can't like withhold. And so basically we started the first like drug delivery service, distributing cocaine around the city. And we made it a bit very, very sophisticated. Everybody that was on my team was wearing business suits, ties. We had business cards. We went to like real fancy places, and we just like, we were operating as a chameleon. Like we dwelled in with, you know, the norm, and we didn't look like we were these stereotypical drug dealers like we were when we were kids, you know, standing on the corner, you know, with a do-rag or a hat turned back and baggy jeans. You know, we were like, let's be incognito, and it worked.
Well, and okay, and which brings me to another point though. I mean, again, this audience probably being pretty ignorant to a lot of this. I know I am. I'm not acting like I'm an expert. Your customer, I mean, they probably didn't look a lot like what people may think they looked. That's what they were, probably in pinstripe suits with bold red ties, and right? Yeah. You know, they're sporting Brioni, and they're some of your best customers. Am I right?
Yeah, doctors, lawyers, judges. I mean, you name it. I even sold to cops. Yeah. You know,
Wow. All right. So you climb up through the life, you become successful as an entrepreneur, as a pharmaceutical entrepreneur of sorts, right? But then all of a sudden, at 23, everything kind of crashes. I want to know what that immediate thought was. And then just kind of like, because is your mom still living?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now all of a sudden, you're going to be incarcerated. So mom's left behind. I got to believe that was heartbreaking for both of you. What's going through your mind, and how are you processing, and not just... did you face some depression? What was the game plan when that first night in the cell, at least seven years ahead of you, most likely? I bet they probably sentenced you to more, and maybe you were able to get it down to seven, just knowing the way the penal system works. But what are you thinking, and how are you processing that in those early moments?
Yeah, I had a son.
Wow, okay. I did not know that.
Yeah, my ex-wife and my son at the time, like, that was like...
Wow.
My mind. like, where, you know, what am I going to do with my kid? He's going to grow up with without a father. And I remember, you know, going, being incarcerated and being sent to the precinct and then being sent to the interrogation room. And I just had like an F it attitude. You know, I was just like, you know, I did this. You guys got all the evidence. They caught me with a kilo and a half and money, and they had like 40 undercover sales on us, and it was a whole thing. So I knew I was gonna go down, and they were trying to scare me. They were like, you know, we're gonna give you 24 years for this. So I'm facing 12 to 24 years. They're trying to give me the max. They literally was like clapping as I was walking into the precinct. So they made it seem, which, you know, and if you look my case up and it says like one of the most significant cases in 2009, it was my case in the city. And yeah, no, that was my mindset. But then I was not scared. I was just like, give me the 24 years. I did this, you know, whatever, you know, let's move forward. And I just felt like I needed to really take responsibility for what I've done. And I got caught, and it was my third felony that I was going to face a long time. And I was just ready to do the time, you know, and that was my mindset.
All right. And then, so I told you I have a very close family member who has spent the majority of his life in and out of incarceration. And I remember, Koss, I told you I was going to tell you this story. So he and I reconnect here recently, and we're having dinner at my house. And I remember asking him a question. I said, so, because right now he's working like 7 days a week with, like you said, it's very difficult to get a driver's license. It's difficult to get, you know, a job like any of us would like to have. It's a struggle for him. And so he's working like 7 days a week, hardcore physical labor. And I asked him the question, if you were able to do what you are really passionate about, what would you do? Now, Koss, he had to sit there for a moment, and he really couldn't come up with an answer. It was almost like that was just so far out of reach for him to even consider such a thing. And so now I would like you to take this, and you take it wherever you want to, but this is just kind of what I'm thinking. So now you are incarcerated, but in a way, that's where Combody starts. That's where this new chapter, the seed is planted. Talk to those other individuals, like my family member and others, that they may feel like my past is what defines me, and therefore I can never escape it, as opposed to what you've done, which to me, your present defines you, my man. You are a successful entrepreneur in the fitness industry that has this past that you took hold of, which gives you, to me, more credibility for what you're asking of your clientele, right? To change their lives, to change their body, you know, change your body, change the world. You have put this into practice, and you have lived the story. So with the mindset of someone listening to this, that, and maybe it's not they went to prison, maybe they've just screwed up, but how did you start to realize, okay, my life's not over. I will not be defined by this. On the other side of this, there will be success. And, you know, and go back to where, you know, you start the healthy habits, and then what drove you to get so passionate about that, that it wasn't just about your health for you, but you decide, you share it with inmates. I mean, that's awesome. You start to become a leader within, you know, so kind of take us through that little process.
Yeah. So when I was incarcerated, like we worked out together, and you know, I helped over 20 inmates, was over 1,000 pounds combined. It was like
that's awesome.
It was a camaraderie builder. I didn't think I was gonna come home and start a business behind it. It was not until I ended up in solitary confinement towards the end of my incarceration, where I was in 24-hour lockdown. You know, it was.
Koss, is that as bad as everybody says? I mean, I from what I understand, solitary confinement is like it's worse than people can even imagine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, you get 2-3 showers a week, depending on what prison you're in.
Right.
And limited food, you know, and you have no social contact. You know, you're just basically alone in your thoughts. And, you know, a lot of people during the pandemic were like, I can't deal with this being locked down at home and all this stuff. Imagine when you have a little sink that's sprinkling a little bit of water, and it's 100 and something degrees in a cell, and you're suffocating, you know, and
Yeah.
You know, you have a small little constrained space where you can't even move around. You know, at least you have a house and maybe a backyard, you know, that you could get some fresh air. Like we had none of that, you know.
And what did it do to you with regard to now being able to walk into your own gym and just the, I mean, I've never been in that situation, but I have been on the verge of death on the other side of the world, where all of a sudden just being back to have a glass of ice water. I still to this day, my wife gets tired of hearing me say, I love ice water. It's just, you start to appreciate the little things. What did it do to you in your perception of life, of freedom, of being, of what you have in front of you?
When you step out of those gates, I mean, the air, like, smell and taste different.
Really?
You know? It's crazy, but you want to kiss the floor. You want to just appreciate and the taste of everything. Like, you're just eating like really bland food while you're in there. Like, everything just, your taste buds just like amplify. Your dopamine levels are like, you know, it's crazy. I mean, it's amazing. You feel great, you know. And like you mentioned, you know, just that glass of water is. It could feel like heaven for a second, you know, so.
But so you start helping these guys. And again, you said you didn't really, you weren't in there thinking, I'm going to get out of here and start a business. But also something comes to mind, and I want you to touch on this, or if this had an impact at all or not. Most everything you read that has to do with overcoming depression or finding a purpose in life has to do with outward focus, focusing on the benefit of others. How much did helping those 20 guys lose a combined 1,000 pounds, what did that do for you? I mean, they're benefiting, but what did it do for you in your mental state and kind of how it pushed you forward?
It was more of like, you know, giving high fives, like, yo, we did this, you know, like, congratulating each other, you know, dope, and then holding each other accountable. And it was just a consistent thing, you know. We just like got together. I would stand in the middle of a circle, you know, everybody will follow my lead. Somebody else would lead the workouts today, you know, we'll do a different, somebody will come up with a different type of exercise or something, you know. So it was great. I mean, it was just consistent. Like, if you missed a day, you felt like, you felt the biggest regret in your life, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how we worked. But I don't know, when I was in there, I didn't think much of it until I was like in solitary and I wrote out like a mini business plan. And I said, wow, this is what I want to do when I came home. And I was actually in that cell, like just picturing myself looking at the walls and saying like, seeing people, you know, just like I'm training hundreds of people. I felt like I was imagining that I was training hundreds of people outside in the park.
Wow.
And so that was my mental state and what I wanted to do. And I came home and I started doing it. And then it didn't start with hundreds of people. It was, you know, maybe one person, you know, two, three. I remember after like a year and a half in the park, and I think I had 8 people out there, and I was like, oh, I made it, you know, I have a group of 8 people. Now we're hosting classes, you know, we get 100 people out there. You know, I actually went into a Nebraska prison a couple weeks ago, and I had about 120 guys, you know, and I was crushing them in push-ups, you know, so
yeah.
But they were all like hyped and inspired, you know. There was hope, you know, like when you ask your brother, you know, what do you imagine doing? I feel like those guys, they feel the same way. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, I do construction, you know, my cousin has a job back of the kitchen and, you know, I'm going to be, you know, so they all think in this manual labor job, mm-hmm. and not everybody has to like enclose themselves in this box, yeah. You know, where everybody is like picturing a formerly incarcerated person to work in, you know, right. And there's just so many possibilities and there's so much talent in there. I felt like the smartest people I've ever met in my life has been the people that I've been incarcerated with, you know. There's just so much talent, untapped talent, and it's sad.
I could not agree more. And you know, there's so much that you said there, that there's so much science behind and so much that you just, you know, it's an innate with you. Like if you read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, mm-hmm. so much of what, you know, he used in, to survive was envisioning conversations with his wife, like you in that solitary confinement cell, actually making that vision almost come to life. And, you know, now that you're on the other side, have you really studied the power of your story from a clinical or scientific standpoint? Because I'm telling you, Koss, I mean, seriously, what you just described there is so powerful. And a lot of people don't even understand they have that ability to truly envision a life outside. You know, everything starts right between your ears, right? In your own mind. And you've proven that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I haven't been like clinically tested or, you know, done an evaluation or anything like that. But I think, and then I also feel like it depends on the person, you know. Yeah. I feel like that I can't, you know, tell people, oh, you're gonna, if you want to start a company, it's simple, you know, like just do this, do that, do this. Yes, there's certain steps that you can set up, your books, your taxes, you know, your company structure and all this stuff, which is great. But at the end of the day, it's just like you tracking along and just showing up every day to deliver a great product. And, you know, you just got to be consistent, because if you know, the only person that really could quit is yourself. You know, if you feel like you get frustrated and you just want to flip the table and then just walk away, which I've seen a lot of people do, you know. Yeah. I've seen people, even like, you know, a couple, like, for example, I had one guy who came out extremely talented. I hired, you know, I was mentoring him. He got frustrated at a certain point and, you know, just walked away. And then I called him back. But if he didn't have me to like call him back and be like, all right, let's talk about it. Let's, you know, let's see what we could do. And now he's highly successful, making money and doing his thing. And he doesn't get as frustrated at the fact that he had to start from zero and start, you know, his way up. And there was a lot of pressure through his family. But yeah, it takes that one effort, you know, and be like, F it, I'm not doing this anymore, and just walk away, and then everything's done. You know, you just got to be consistent, and a lot of people are not built like that, or don't have the support system around them to help them get through those things.
Well, and you know, going back to Viktor Frankl, you know, he made popular a Nietzsche quote that was, "He who has a big enough why can endure almost any how." So whenever you were, before you went in, your why was money. You wanted to be successful, and you equated true success with monetary success. Then you get out, and things have changed, because there's a lot of things you can do for money, and you have decided to go into the world of health and wellness. So if I were to say to you now, Koss, on the other side of this journey, or at this portion of the journey, it's not over yet. You're a young guy. You've still got a lot to go. If I say to you now, what is your why? What is your why for making sure that Combody is successful, and then just everything you do now, how do you approach it? What is your primary why in life, and how do you keep that focus on it?
Yeah, my why is creating a movement. Creating a movement of anti-vanity.
I love it. Good luck.
Yeah. And I feel like there's where the fitness world is. Like, everything is, you know, and I there's certain parts of my body that I want to, like, you know, I want to get an 8-pack instead of a 6-pack, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to, you know, that, yes, we want to achieve those goals, and it's going to take time, and we're going to get there. But I feel like there's just this facade and this fakeness, and, you know, what we see on social media and what we see on TV, it looks beautiful and it's pretty, but within the inside, it's damaging, you know. Yeah. And then that comes to play with, like, the, you know, formerly incarcerated, the discrimination, and our thoughts of, like, you know, this, the perceptions that we have, you know, really changing that. I don't want to sell a lie. I don't want to say lose 30 pounds in 30 days, you know, with this secret, you know, workout, you know. So I want to be truthful. I want to say, like, hey, this is what it takes. This is what you probably gonna happen if you be consistent and you keep doing the right thing. But I don't want to sell any lies and I don't want to sell any fake dreams. And I feel like this is where the fitness world has taken us for years. And it's always been that way.
Man, I agree. And like, I did a video one time, I think it's still out on my YouTube channel, about don't ever ask me this question. And I think the question was, don't ever ask me, so have you been working out, or, you know, or something like that. Like, it's like I'm doing it just all of a sudden, I just decided I'm on some 6-week program, or are you on a diet? Yeah, because that, but we're so, like, you nailed it. We're so wired to think that the only reason I would ever be in my garage every single morning, 7 days a week, because I don't go to gyms, I get stripped down to, I'd probably be a Calm Body member. If I were gonna go to a gym, that's my wheelhouse, man. That's my vibe. Go where it's just stripped down, give me just the stuff I need to take care of what you said, my temple, because it is. We're on the same page there, brother. And so I get so frustrated when people think that, so why are you doing this for this reason or not? And I want to throw it back to them and go, why in the hell are you not? Do you understand the ancillary benefits of physical fitness well beyond what you look like? Yeah, you're going to look better. That's just kind of a bonus. That's an ancillary benefit. But every study shows you think better. You're more calm. You have more energy. We're going to live longer, right? I mean, science is keeping us alive longer. Why not actually be able to do something whenever you're 85 versus, you know, hurting and not having any strength? But you're right, man. So I love that. And that's kind of, that's why I knew this would be so within what I'm trying to do, this whole idea of improving always and always, because that's my deal, man. It's about overall improvement, not just because I want to look better, but because I want to inspire people to just make their lives better. And physical fitness can be a huge component of that, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where I want to take it. And I feel like we have this community that's been forgotten, of formerly incarcerated individuals that need the opportunity and can inspire and can motivate and have like a huge backstory of hardship. Most of us have insane hardship that we've endured, and I feel like that's in itself inspiring to push somebody to the next level, and I think we could do it. So I don't know, there's where I want, that's my dream.
I love it. Well, and there's something that you said in one of the talks, I can't remember if it was in the Vice interview or your TED talk, where you talk about the recidivism rate and how high it is in the United States. What does this audience not understand about people who get out? Like, I've got to think there's a certain element of institutionalized. That's what I used to think about my brother. I'm like, that's all he knew. And it felt safer. It's kind of like, you know, the Shawshank Redemption, you know, you watch it and it's like, you know, Brooks Hadley, he felt safer inside than outside. Is that it? Or is it, you know, I mean, what is it that causes such a high return rate to the penal system in your estimation?
Yeah, I think, well, like, Brooks is a different story. He did like 50 years or something.
Right. I mean, he spent over half his life there. So you're right.
For those people that have done that amount of time, like, it's really difficult to readapt because, you know, society doesn't understand it day to day. They're not, you know, you don't have to ask permission to use the bathroom, you know, anymore. You know, it's just you have a key now. You know, you don't, before you didn't have a key to open up your cell door, you know, so for so long, you just operated as a robot in a very systematic way. But I think the one of the biggest things that, you know, recidivates a lot of people is the frustration of readapting. We saw there are statistics out there, you know, that's right now there's 76% recidivism rate in the United States. So basically, three out of four people will end up back in the system, you know, within a certain time. But if we give them a job, that drops quickly down to 30%. And if we give them higher education, we give them a college degree, that drops down less than 5%. And so, you know, we at Calm Body have a zero recidivism rate, so no one has gone back into the prison system. I feel like we've all been just very supportive, you know, going through, you know, the stuff that we have to go through, dealing with parole, dealing with housing, dealing with family. You know, it's it could get frustrating, and especially when you don't have money to keep going. And so, like, when I came home, like, I couldn't, it was hard for me to find a job, and I figured it out. But for the most part, most people that come home and they get tired of looking for jobs and left and right, and they're just being told no, 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 you're like, all right, I know how to get this, you know, let me go back to the streets. And I could do this quick move and I could get away with it. And most of the time, yeah, they'll get away with it once, twice, maybe three times, and then eventually back in the system, you know. So it's frustrating. It's frustrating.
All right. Well, I want to talk about Combody. I want you to be able to, I want this audience to know everything about it. And here's kind of my take on what you did. Whenever I was reading Big Little Breakthroughs and I first learned of you, I thought, you know, this is kind of like the Eminem moment in the final rap battle, where he throws out all the insults that could possibly thrown at him before his opponent had the chance, and said, and owned it, said, here's who I am. Now what? You took something, what everything that we've talked about through this conversation that has become kind of the scarlet letter on so many others, you took it, owned it, and you have figured out a way to brand it, you made beauty for ashes is what you did, you know. And so talk about what Combody is. It's obviously a big component of this movement that you're leading. So tell the listener what it is. What does it look like? What do you expect? I mean, I know a member is an inmate, right? I mean, it's cool how you branded everything. And again, you flipped the script in such a cool way, man. So talk to the audience about Combody.
Yeah, I feel freedom, you know, with just talking about my past and being accepted from where I came from, you know. So when I first started Combody, I didn't name it Combody. I called it Cross Athletics, and I had our tagline was Prison Style Bootcamp. And yeah, I wanted to name it like ConFit. I was messing around with the names, and Combody came about, but I was hiding the fact that we had like a prison component until I met that person. And I was like, hey, we're doing a prison style boot camp. You know, this was derived from my personal experience where I lost 70 pounds in 6 months. And I'll give them a little pitch line before, like when people used to come for the first time into a class and they didn't know, you know, they thought they were just walking into a regular fitness class. And so there was a few times that people walked away. And people discriminated, and they were like, you were locked up, I don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. And I remember the last time it happened, I was in the middle of a class, and I was like renting out little ballet studios at the time, and I was like, don't worry, I didn't kill nobody, I only did 6 years in prison. I went to get, like, made it super sarcastic joke and went to give a lady a high five, and she was like, don't touch me, I don't want to be associated with this. And I don't know what her background was, or, you know, maybe she's gone through something in her life that made her feel like she feels a certain way about people that have been incarcerated. So I don't want to judge her, you know, but also, like, there's a lot of people with that mentality. And she walked away, and I was like, she's not cut out for prison. And everybody in the room started laughing. and she walked away like super angry, and she wrote me a bad review or whatever. And so, but I was like, you know what, I gotta be upfront with it. And so I started really thinking about changing up the branding and changing up, you know, what they're gonna go through. And so when I opened up the studio, I built the gate, I made a mugshot wall, people take 5 minute showers, it's a dark room, cinder blocks around, you know. So I felt more freedom when people walked in and they knew what they were getting into, and I didn't have to be hiding. For example, when I went to go apply for a job application, like, I was scared to check yes, I've been convicted of a criminal record, and sometimes I would like do a light mark or just leave it blank, and and eventually they'll find out. But now, hey, if you check box the yes box with me, you know, that's a plus. So I really started changing that whole mentality of like, let's talk about your past and let's be accepted for where we came from. And I felt definitely way more free when I started branding and just share my story, and I have nothing to hide now, you know, I'm on.
Man, and you touched on something, man, I think is so freaking powerful, Koss, is that you walking out through the gates, the air smelled better, the food tasted better, you were free. But that was just one component of the freedom. Now it's not just about being free from the bars, but you're free to be who you really are. And that's something that I'm constantly trying to tell people. And I've had to learn in my 46 years. It's you mentioned something, and you know, so many people walk through this life in the witness protection program. They really do. They're so afraid to be who they are, to own who they are, and that they walk around with, you said it, the mask on. Don't let anyone know who I really am. But you are living proof, owning yourself, knowing who you are. That is what has ultimately set you free. So well done, my man. Not everybody can do it. I mean, it's a tough hill to climb for a lot of people. It has been for me. My ego got in the way so many times of me just being who I am. And so to hear that story, dude, that's powerful for me, man. I think it's powerful for anybody that hears that.
Yeah, and our clients like really resonate with it, you know, and opening up, and they start sharing their stories, and it just becomes like for example, you know, you and I walking around probably at home, you know, saying my brothers came out of prison, you know, and now you could freely talk about it, you know. I remember my family, my brothers and sisters, they became successful in the business world, and my brother actually won a political position. He's a city council member of downtown Manhattan now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, huge position.
But I was a city councilman in Tyler, Texas, but that's a little different than Manhattan. I mean, town of 100,000 people. I represent a district in a town of 100,000 people. He probably has more than 100,000 people in one of the blocks in his district. So that's awesome, man.
Yeah, so it's a big, but when I came home, you know, my family members didn't want to talk about my past with anybody. Like, when I was incarcerated, they would say, oh, you know, I have four of us, but they will only say that there were three of them.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to explain why, you know, what does your brother do, you know?
Right.
So
right
now they're open and free to share my story, and they're proud of, you know, where what I've been through and gone through and where I'm going, you know?
Well, and look what you've done with it, though, man. That's why I don't want this to come across as false flattery, but look what you have made it. I mean, you did that, Koss. You made it acceptable and to turn something like this into, I would imagine now, and I know how, you know, he's your brother, but I know how politicians work. If you know, Koss is my brother, I'm going to point to him and go, yeah, that's my brother, you know, because you've taken and you've turned, you know, beauty for ashes. And I think that's so important. And, you know, there's people listening to this podcast that I want the listener to know, from me, the host, Jason Wright, you know, I've been through a divorce. It took me forever. It's still to this day, it's kind of like, I don't want anybody to know that. I don't want to tell anybody that or whatever. There are probably bankers listening to this that have been pinched for embezzlement. There is somebody out there with a DWI. Your prison is whatever you make it, right? We create our own prisons in our mind and those things that hold us back from going forward and sharing our story and trying to help others. And generally, whenever you're trying to hide a story, you're putting together a false narrative, and that is usually driven by pride and ego, which will bite you in the ass every time. I've learned sometimes the hard way in my life. Am I right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, the truth will set you free.
Amen. Amen. Well, hey, Koss, I know you have a business to run. This was so awesome. And, you know, I'm so glad. I think that, you know, I believe in divine appointments. I think the reason why I picked up Big Little Breakthroughs is for this conversation. And I want you to know that anything that I can do to help with your movement, that if there's ever anything that I can push through this audience or anything, my wife and I are usually in New York about four times a year, but you know, things have kind of changed here recently because we have a retail store where we go to market up there. And but the next time she's gonna get to go in September, I don't get to go with her, but the next time we're up there, man, I would love to you know, take you to dinner and say thank you. And you're actually my third guest in the Manhattan area. So maybe we'll just have a Jason Wright podcast alumni dinner or something. I'll have to put something together up there.
Maybe do a workout with us.
I will definitely take you up on that, my man. So, well, let everybody know where they can find you, how they can support you, and anything else. Before we go, I want the mic is yours.
No, thank you. So yeah, you can check me out at combody.com if you feel like you want to do a donation or just simply sign up for a class. You could just find our information there, or you could hit us up on Instagram at conbody. That's C-O-N Nancy B-O-D-Y con Vic body. All right,
man. All right, Koss, thank you for being here, brother. I'm so grateful for your time.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate you.
Well, that does it for this episode of The Jason Wright Show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been a Texas Titan Media production. Fourth Wall did the music. And as always, thank you so much for listening. Please consider going out to jasonwrightnow.com and signing up for the Vitruvian Letter. Also, please go out to iTunes. It takes like 30 seconds to just leave us a 5-star rating. It does wonders for the podcast. I would be so grateful. And with that, until we meet again, go crush it and endeavor to improve always in all ways. I'm out.